Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button. From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Coming up on this week's show, lessons about life, love, and Kappa Chow from Louis C.K.'s Pootie Tang.
Later in the show, we'll bring you cue shots, our look at some of the current offerings on various streaming and VOD sites, all centered around a common theme. Inspired by Pootie Tang, we were all ready to discuss movies in which people are attacked by gorillas. But Matt, you were a little concerned the pro-gorilla lobby would come after us and, you know, accuse us of anti-simian bias. That would not do. So instead, we're going to look at movies that were directed by stand-up comedians turned filmmakers.
Okay, so let's get to cue shots. Our theme this week again is stand-up comedians turned directors, inspired by Louis C.K., famous stand-up comedian turned director turned television auteur. Allison, before we get to our picks here, is there anything we want to say in a general sense? I thought it was kind of interesting to look at it this way, personally. As I was making a list, thinking about it, watching these movies, I was wondering, how is stand-up comedy as a training ground for directing? Is it a good training ground? Does it give you skills you can use as a director, or does it not? Or perhaps is it both?
That's an interesting approach, especially since stand-up is more and more recently so personal. You know, there's like such a tendency lately towards that direction in stand-up, which has always been a part, but more so now. And I think that maybe offers an interesting angle to filmmaking, mm-hmm. but stand-up is ultimately a solo act. It is about standing on a stage, and it is about people liking you or mm-hmm. the persona that you put out there. And filmmaking is collaborative. No matter, you know, how much you want to take on every role, you have to work with other people. You have to work with actors. You have to work with studios, which doesn't always end up so good for a lot of these people who've made movies, including the one that we're going to talk about for our main review. So I think that there is a bit of a clash there in terms of the kind of natural solo act that is a stand-up show versus working with a lot of people to make a film.
I agree that there are certain, I think there are certain skills that you probably learn as a comedian that serve you well as a director. And then there are probably some skills that you don't learn as a stand-up that you're probably going to need as a director that you'll need to learn somewhere else. Certainly, as you said, the idea of collaboration. I mean, one of the things that is so interesting about stand-up, especially as you said, as it's being practiced now, is it's this really personal venue of artistic expression. I mean, you can say whatever you want. I mean, it's real, like, freedom of speech. It's real, true, personal expression, and there's no money men. No one can tell you don't have the budget to tell that story in your stand-up. You know, no one can say, well, we can't afford to shoot that, or we don't have the number of days in our budget to achieve that story. There are, I guess, are certain limitations. You have to work within a certain amount of time as a stand-up. You've only got X number of minutes. You've got to keep the audience paying attention somehow. It's not like you can just ramble for 40 minutes and not tell a joke. Probably if you don't at a stand-up comedy show, somebody's going to get upset. But on the other hand, you're limited only by your imagination and your writing. And so it is much more of a direct personal venue. But on the other hand, that probably serves you pretty well when you become a director, right? If you are really passionate, if you have a voice, if you have a vision, and you're willing to work to execute it, the odds are less likely, maybe, that you'll get trampled on. But then again, in the case of our listener's choice review, maybe it depends on how much power you have or how experienced you are, and you're still open to studio meddling and trampling. I guess it depends. So on the one hand, the two have almost nothing in common. On the other hand, I feel like there are certain connections. And I know one of my three picks, I think I'm going to discuss this a little more, because I think although I had never thought about it this way until this week and thinking about this podcast, I think you can absolutely read it as a statement about stand-up and that background versus directing and the skills that's required.
Yeah, and it is also really interesting to see someone who you have a real personal sense of in terms of their comedy because you've listened to their stand-up, to see what kind of film they choose to make, because it's not always in the line of the comedy that they have done on stage.
Very true.
You know, I something like Sleepwalk With Me is definitely like a very direct kind of interesting translation of a stand-up act turned one-man show turned film.
Right. We mentioned that on the last show. That was Mike Birbiglia's new movie.
Right, which is on VOD right now.
Right.
But then something like, you know, Chris Rock made I Think I Love My Wife, which, if I'm not mistaken, is a remake of a Romare film.
Very, it's a loose remake, but yes, yeah, it's based on a Romare film. And apparently he's a big Romare fan, is what he says. But,
yeah. Or Takeshi Kitano, who, you know, started a career as a stage comedian and then has made some very interesting films all over the place, including some very famous violent gangster films.
Right.
You know, or Larry David made Sour Grapes, which is a film that I think even he was not particularly happy about, but that was maligned, widely maligned by many people. So, it, you know, before he went on to make this a TV show that was much more in his own voice.
Well, he'd already made Seinfeld.
Seinfeld, yeah, but to go on to yes. Yeah.
He and went back to television. He tried film, found that it, you know, didn't work for him, and he then went back to sort of almost like a hybrid of stand-up, because he's playing himself and he's speaking really in his own voice.
Right.
And he's clearly the author of the show, and he's got, I don't think he's got a lot of people telling him what to do.
Right. So it is really interesting to see these ventures, whether successful or failed, I think, in the context of someone's stand-up career.
The one other general thing I wanted to say before we get to our picks is, as we're talking here, I think what we're finding in some cases are stand-ups who are also storytellers, because storytelling is so crucial to stand-up, and it's certainly crucial to filmmaking. And it's interesting because, you know, there is, you can be a stand-up by telling jokes, you know, by telling 100 jokes in 20 minutes, just joke. And I've seen comedians like that who are great. I mean, we could name some, you know, like, I don't necessarily think of like Stephen Wright as a great storyteller, but he's a great joke teller and he's hilarious. But that's his sort of thing. Would I necessarily want to see his directorial debut? I don't know. I'd have a hard time imagining it. But then again, on the other hand, like a guy like Louis C.K., I mean, his stand-up are, they're these stories, you know, these wonderful stories. So I can see the connection, even though the movie we're about to discuss is not necessarily the most brilliantly narrative-driven film of all time. I look at him now, at least, and I can see a connection there. All right, so should we get to our picks? You want to go first?
Sure. My first one is actually an extremely personal film, so that'll fit in well to this discussion. It's JoJo Dancer, Your Life is Calling, 1986 film, directed by Richard Pryor and starring Richard Pryor. It's available on a service that you might, I've never seen this publicized, but you might actually have it if you are a Comcast subscriber. It's Xfinity Stream Picks, which is a service they seem to have, Comcast is offering as an added value. You can also subscribe to it for $5 a month if you already have TV through them. But you should look if you have like their triple play or whatever their equivalent is, you might have free access to this. So streaming there, you know, Richard Pryor has always said this film is not autobiographical, but, you know, when you watch it and you see that it is a film in which he plays a successful, edgy stand-up comedian who has a terrible incident in which he's badly burned while freebasing cocaine, you start to think maybe he's not being entirely upfront in saying that. He wrote this film with Rocco Urbisky and Paul Mooney, and it's basically, as far as you can read it against what he says, the story of his life from growing up in a brothel in the Midwest to slowly establishing himself as a comedian, finding his voice, going from kind of more standard joke telling to something, you know, that examines race and that pushes boundaries, engages the crowd sometimes in aggressive ways, and also about how he gets caught up in womanizing and drug abuse and kind of falls apart. And the framing of this is that JoJo Dancer has this incident where he's at home, he's trying really hard to resist the urge to get high. He ends up at one point like crawling in the carpet looking for crack rocks. And then he, you know, having vowed that he's not going to do this again, he finds some drugs. He pulls his pipe out of the fireplace where he tried to burn it, and then he ends up in the hospital because of this incident that we see later. But he basically, his like alter ego, his soul maybe, climbs out of his body and offers him this tour through his life, basically to urge him to clean up and change his life. And it's particularly poignant, knowing Richard Pryor's kind of story, how successful he ever is at cleaning up. But It's really interesting in terms of him telling his own story.
Hi, little JoJo.
Hi.
How was school? Let's go, girls.
Who made the biggest horn? Hallelujah. Sammy Lord hit me.
JoJo, get off of that lawn.
Yes, Mama.
It's also, I'd say, only sometimes aiming to be funny. Other times it's, you know, the details are so harsh and so rough that it's not necessarily comedy, but it, as a kind of look at him as a person and at his growth as a comedian and how that's paralleled by the mess he starts making of his personal life, it's really, really interesting. So that is JoJo Dancer, Your Life is Calling, Richard Pryor's lone scripted directorial effort, and it is available for streaming on Xfinity Stream Picks.
Wow, that is a cool pick. I have never seen that movie. We've talked about it before.
We mentioned it before. I had not seen it. I finally got to see it in prep for this.
Sounds pretty interesting.
I was glad to, yeah.
Okay, well, my pick, not quite as personal, but I think it speaks to... This was the one I was going to discuss that, as I mentioned before, I think speaks to the divide between the stand-up comedian as the artist who can do whatever he wants and the director who has to work with other people. And it's the 1968 film The Producers, directed by Mel Brooks, who was a stand-up comedian. He worked in the Catskills and became a joke writer on television, and that went on well enough. He became a popular performer with Carl Reiner. They had their whole 2,000-year-old man routine, and eventually he became a director in his own right. And The Producers was his directorial debut. Now, like I said, I've never thought of The Producers in this way. I just usually think of it as a really wonderfully funny movie. It's one of the funniest movies of all time. But when you think about it, it is sort of about the lunacy of the collaborative creative process, because everything that these producers do is defined by money. It's all about money. Now, in this case, they're not exactly altruistic artists. They're greedy. They have a scheme to make money off of producing. But I think there is a way to look at it as a commentary on this idea, because not only do they have to get the money and everything that they do and anything anyone does, in this case it's the theater business, but could be read as film as well, is based on money, but it's also based on the people you work with. They have to get the money, but then they also have to find a writer and get him to agree to give them his stage play. And this screenwriter is crazy. He's also a Nazi. And they have to get a director, and the director's kind of kooky. They need a star. The star is this crazy, whacked-out hippie guy. So it's interesting how you could read the whole thing as almost like a expression of frustration. As a writer, as a stand-up, I have complete control over what I want to say and do. But then when I move into Broadway or film or whatever it is, now I have to go speak to a writer. I have to go speak to a director. I have to go beg little old ladies for money, all these sorts of things.
You know, not many people knew it, but the Führer was a terrific dancer.
Really, I never dreamed that...
That is because that you were taken in by that verdammte Allied propaganda!
Such filthy lies, they told lies! But nobody ever said a bad word about Winston Churchill, did they? Oh, when was Winnie? Churchill! With his cigars, with his brandy, and his rotten painting, rotten! Hitler, there was a painter. He could paint an entire apartment in one afternoon, two coats!
I don't necessarily think anyone thinks about these things when they watch The Producers, nor necessarily should they, but I do think maybe it's there a little bit, and I think that's kind of interesting. I always think of myself as, like, this average viewer, but then I talk to people and they're like, oh yeah, I've never really seen... I've seen Spaceballs, you know, like... Mel Brooks, I grew up watching like every Mel Brooks movie. Like, he was an icon to me, but I wonder if he's holding up that status, Allison, and I'm maybe a little concerned that he's not, that maybe he seems a little passé, a little cheesy. I don't know. So I want to make sure, if you haven't seen The Producers, the original Producers, God forbid you should watch the movie. The Broadway musical of The Producers was great, but the movie was not. So if you haven't seen The Producers, please, please go out of your way and find it. It is available on Netflix streaming right now.
Okay, well, my next pick is A New Leaf. It's the 1971 movie from Elaine May, who, you know, was a comedian whose stage partner was Mike Nichols, who went on to have his own career as a director, made The Graduate, Catch 22, Closer. New Leaf is available on Amazon Instant, and I think was not available on DVD for a while. It just got a re-release from Olive, so it's, you know,
unavailable for a while.
Yeah, so exciting that it's all available now. This was Elaine May's directorial debut. She also starred in it, and had a problematic time with the studio, which became a pattern with her work, most notoriously with Ishtar, you know, the famous flop. But this is a really charming and some unexpectedly dark and yet really warm comedy. It stars Walter Matthau as Henry Graham, who is just a horrible person. He is a confirmed bachelor, he's inherited a lot of wealth, which he's just frittered away, despite being warned multiple times by his financial advisor that he was living well beyond his means. So he runs completely out of money and decides that he needs to marry into it. And he borrows money from his uncle, who hates him. And so he has a particular timeline that he needs to marry by. He needs to marry in 6 weeks. And he thinks this is impossible, and he's not particularly interested. One of the things that's maybe kind of charming about his character is he has no interest in women, not because he has another preference, but because he just is only really interested in himself and in indulging in having nice things, including it's a Ferrari that can't really, it's a beautiful car that's constantly getting towed to be worked on. He can't drive it without it breaking down, but he loves it. So he meets Henrietta, who is played by Elaine May, who is this mousy, clumsy heiress who is a botanist, and her great love is botany. And she wants to discover a new variety of fern. He courts her, despite being pretty disgusted by her. He calls her a primitive or feral. She has no taste in wine. She's constantly knocking things over onto his carpet, which he adores. She has giant glasses. She loves talking about plants. He plans to murder her quite earnestly, and yet finds himself slowly warming to her, despite his aversion to all things that are not basically luxury goods. And the film really manages to have this dark undertone in that while he's courting her, he's reading up on books of toxicology so that he can poison her, but manages to make his transformation. He turns over a new leaf, as the title implies, but pretty sweet, mostly because Henrietta is so unguarded and vulnerable. There's a scene in which she manages to have put her nightgown on incorrectly. So one of her arms is inside the nightgown. She can't eat dinner. And he helps her try to figure out that her head is in the armhole. And that's why this is problematic.
Henrietta, where is your other arm?
It's in the nightgown. It's a Grecian style nightgown. It fits over one shoulder and the other arm goes inside. It's very uncomfortable. I can barely move my head all the way around.
It's fine. I just think you have your head through the armhole. If you just stand up for a minute. That's it. There you are. I think, you see, you have your head through the armhole.
Oh.
Now, pick your arm up. No, not that one.
And the scene goes on for quite a while, and it's both, ridiculous in that they're struggling over putting on this dress the proper way, like she's a child. And yet it's really weirdly sweet in that she, appreciates it so much, and he is kind of touched by this need to take care of her. So that's A New Leaf. It's available for streaming on Amazon.
All right. Well, you're shaming me left and right this week because I haven't seen A New Leaf either. So it's another one that I've always wanted to check out. But
it's been hard to see.
It's been hard to see, but I'm not going to make excuses here, Allison. I'm just going to say I haven't seen it yet, but you're encouraging me to make sure that I make time to see it very soon. My next pick is from 1973. It's available on Netflix, and it's a little movie called Sleeper, directed by one Woody Allen, who, of course, got his start as a stand-up and a writer, writing for other stand-ups, and then finally working up the courage to become a performer himself. And then he, of course, became really famous as a stand-up, and then basically just quit stand-up and never did it ever again. He went from being one of the most popular stand-ups in the country to just never doing it again and moving into film. Clearly, that was what he always wanted to do. And Sleeper, in this context, is kind of interesting to talk about because, you know, it doesn't bear a ton of hallmarks of, you know, it's not a JoJo Dancer. This is not a personal story of a man struggling to be a stand-up comic and struggling with substance abuse. There's very little on the surface that we could connect to Woody Allen's life as a New York intellectual comedian. But maybe we could find something of him in this story of a man who is frozen. He goes into the hospital for an ulcer operation and never wakes up. They have there's a complication, and then he's put into suspended animation, much like the classic Demolition Man. And there's a lot of parallels that could be drawn between the two masterpieces. And then he wakes up in the future, like a couple hundred years in the future, in this sort of weird dystopian future where the government is sort of Big Brother-ish and freedom has been suppressed, and he gets involved with kind of like the underground revolution movement.
Well, he's fully recovered, except for a few minor kinks.
Has he asked for anything special?
Yes, this morning for breakfast, he requested something called wheat germ, organic honey, and tiger's milk.
Oh, yes, those are the charm substances that some years ago were felt to contain life-preserving properties.
You mean there was no deep fat? No steak or cream pies or hot fudge?
Those were thought to be unhealthy. Precisely the opposite of what we now know to be true.
Incredible.
So the part that I guess you could sort of look at and compare to stand-up comedy is just this idea that he's sort of wandering through the world as a kind of outsider and observer and commentator. You know, the thing about Sleeper is that as different and crazy as the world is, it's not all that different, and that you could potentially say that it's all one big commentary on life in the 70s, not life in the 2270s, perhaps. So, again, another movie that I imagine most of the people listening have probably already heard, but I don't know. I'm feeling out of touch lately, Allison. I'm feeling old and out of touch, and I guess I just want to know that people are watching these movies that mean a lot to me. So, you know, if I'm wrong, and if every person under the age of 25 has already seen Sleeper and seen the early Woody Allen movies, don't listen to me. But if you haven't, then check it out. You know, I was talking with somebody who's a little younger than us recently, and he loves early Woody Allen, but he says he has a hard time convincing people to watch early Woody Allen. Like, they'll watch the later Woody Allens. Like, they've seen Crimes and Misdemeanors, and they've seen, you know, even Annie Hall, right? And even Manhattan. Like, that's as far back as they go. You know, whereas the old stereotype was always, why doesn't he make movies like The Funny Ones? I feel like I'm starting to get a sense that for some people, he's almost not that guy. He's the guy who made the serious movies. And that the early comedies are almost seen as sort of like
an aberration.
An aberration,
yeah,
or
him
infantile
working himself
or
out.
Immature.
Yeah,
exactly. And they are immature in a delightful way. So I guess I'm really curious about whether some of our listeners feel that same way. But either way, it is a great movie. It holds up really well. You know, I was watching it again last night and seeing all these sort of how much, you know, Idiocracy is clearly kind of inspired by it. So, again, it's Sleeper by Woody Allen, and it's available on Netflix.
All right. Well, my last pick is a more recent film. It is World's Greatest Dad, 2009 film, currently available streaming on Netflix, directed by Bobcat Goldthwait, who, you know, started off as a stand-up and then became kind of, for better or worse.
Infamous
for his roles in the Police Academy films.
And now Allison will do her impression of Bobcat Goldthwait. Go!
I don't have one.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Too bad.
I don't know if I've ever seen a Police Academy film.
What?
I know.
What?
Calm down.
Well, I know what the listener's choice options are going to be next week.
Right. Do you
Police
have
Academy
a...
2, Police Academy 4, and Police Academy 3.
Thank
you. In that order.
Yeah. Do you have a Bobcat Goldthwait impression to offer?
No.
Okay.
God, no.
Good. So, haunted. His career is kind of haunted by... this character, but he
Zed. The character's name was Zed.
Yeah,
let's give him some respect.
He even has talked about how he had to, you know, while doing stand up, and was expected to do the voice and all
right.
of that. He had to basically cut it off one day, and a lot of people did not like that. Where
right.
he had to just be like, "That's past now.
Zed's dead, baby."
Exactly.
Zed's dead.
So you know, he had made an early film called Shakes the Clown, but. You know, his more recent career, which has been a group of really dark comedies that have all, I think, premiered at Sundance. have been really interesting. And World's Greatest Dad is my favorite of the bunch. The other two are Sleeping Dogs Lie and God Bless America. And World's Greatest Dad stars Robin Williams as Lance Clayton, a high school English teacher who dreams of being a famous writer and who is a single father to a 15-year-old boy named Kyle, played by Daryl Sabara, who is just a terrible little kid. He is just awful and dies in a autoerotic asphyxiation accident in which, like, he arranges so that this looks like a suicide to kind of save his child, like, posthumously, the embarrassment of being found that way. So he writes a suicide letter that ends up getting published in the school newspaper, you know, not his plan. And so many people respond so well to it that it becomes famous and leads him to kind of go on this road in which he maybe uses his son's death as a way to get more of his writing out under the name of his son. And that's an incredibly great, dark premise, and I think showcases Goldthwait's like sense of humor and ability to make these jokes that are just so out there and potentially offensive, and then also have a really kind of sweet, heartfelt core to his film. And I think in this case, beyond just the having a whole film based around a faked teen suicide, there's also this real interesting approach to the idea of when you're finally able to make your imperfect child, you know, better, kind of remake them after the fact. And in which case, like, Lance, beyond just writing for him, he invents a fondness for Bruce Hornsby for his child. He, you know, makes him basically, like, the school kind of takes him up as this martyr, as this, like, person who speaks the truth. And I think the film really has a great moment towards the end where he just has to acknowledge, like, his kid was his kid as he was, you know, warts and all, or maybe mostly warts.
Mr. Clayton?
Andrew.
It doesn't seem right, does it?
What doesn't seem right?
How everyone is acting. Like they like Kyle.
No, it doesn't.
You know what else is weird?
What?
Kyle's suicide note.
In what way?
That stuff about being an insignificant molecule bouncing around in a meaningless, godless universe. Don't take this the wrong way, but Kyle was a...
What?
Kind of dumb.
Ha! No. Kyle was actually smart, Andrew. He, you know, he just pretended to be dumb, even around you. So, you know, people wouldn't pick on him.
Yeah. Maybe.
The way that the film is so unflinching about that and refusing to soften up Kyle's character is kind of wonderful. And the film also makes a great use of Under Pressure as a musical cue. It's World's Greatest Dad, Bobcat Goldthwait. Really funny, very dark film, available for streaming on Netflix.
Okay. I'm not the biggest fan of that movie.
You prefer Sleeping Dogs Lie?
Yeah, I do. But I do like, I mean, I like the stuff he's doing, and I just like the idea that, you know, he does seem like a guy who's really trying to apply that sort of freedom of expression side of stand-up where you can say anything.
Yeah.
And trying to find a way in movies to do that. And what's interesting is how that ends up being like these tiny little independent movies that like no one will finance, that he has to like scrounge up the money for, and they're seen by very small amounts of people. I think it's maybe a sad commentary on the way that film works, but I'm glad he's out there doing it, that's
yeah.
for sure. Yeah,
and I think that his approach of being like, I'm going to choose the most outrageous premise and then find heart in it and not have that seem like a cop-out is something he does really well.
Mm. Okay, well, my last pick, briefly, because we're running out of time here, is Cemetery Junction from 2010, directed by Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant. It's available on Netflix. And here's a little bit more of an obscure choice, because this movie never, or basically never, played in theaters in America. And you go, well, how did, like, the movie from the guys who created The Office, their first movie together, anyway, Gervais has made one other movie with a different collaborator, The Invention of Lying, which is interesting. How did that movie not get released? And I guess probably just because it's not a fantastic film, and it's also not really a comedy. It's actually more of a coming-of-age drama, which is kind of interesting. It's about these three teenagers who are growing up in this area of Reading. There is a actual place called Cemetery Junction in the town, in the real town, in the real England. I think that title does suggest a certain amount of sort of like dead-end-ism or fear of being dead-ended. And that's, I guess, what's kind of interesting in connection with this being a work by Ricky Gervais, is that is actually a theme when you think about it that does appear in a lot of his work, this sort of fear of provincialism. When you look at the original Office and you look at even Extras to some degree, there is this sort of looking down on small town life and also a fear of it, like a fear of this is all you're ever going to be, that you're going to wind up working in a paper company or in a factory and you're going to just work there and work there and work there until you die and that's your life. And that being the worst possible thing that could happen to anyone. And that's sort of what the story is about here. Two of the friends, one of them does work in a factory and the other one has basically quit to start a new job that he sees as his path out of Cemetery Junction, which is to be a door-to-door insurance salesman. And it's a strange movie just because it has this really great cast, including Ralph Fiennes and Matthew Good and Ricky Gervais in a small role, but the main characters are these sort of unknown actors. So you have this sort of tension between like these young guys who you don't know, and then every time there's a supporting actor in the film, oh, you go, oh, there's Ralph Fiennes, oh, there's Matthew Good, oh, there's Ricky Gervais. But then you kind of constantly are leaving them to focus on these other characters who aren't all that interesting. I mean, it's really not a fantastic movie. I wouldn't say this is like a rush out and, you know, rent it right away kind of thing, but I'm not asking you to rush out and rent it. It's available on Netflix and you can stream it anytime you want. And I think if you are a fan of The Office and Extras and Ricky Gervais's stand-up specials and stuff, I do think it's an interesting part of his sort of oeuvre and that it is not necessarily overly comic. There are jokes. The Gervais character is the father of one of the men or the young boys or whatever you want to call them, and he provides sort of the comic relief essentially by being this exasperated family man whose children and the grandmother in the house, and everyone just kind of, you know, rags on him, and he takes the abuse and says a lot of sarcastic comments, and that's where a lot of the comedy comes from.
It's absolutely, what are you, stupid idiot?
Buy a policy.
No.
Who's going to pay for your funeral?
I've got a few years yet.
Not with all that fat round your arm. I know I'm not paying for it.
Like you'll still be around when I go. Bury me in the garden if you want. I don't care.
Yeah, he buries everything in the garden. An old mangle down there, old cooker.
Not paying the council to take away rubbish.
Well, you better start digging a hole for him soon, because I'm not doing it.
You won't be alive when I die. You'll all be buried down there with the mangle.
That remind me to do that next week, Kath.
Dad, buy a policy or I'll be out of work on Monday.
Good. You can help me dig your grandmother's grave.
I do find it interesting to have a filmmaker or a pair of filmmakers in this case who've always kind of straddled the line a little bit between sort of comedy and also despair. You know, The Office is really funny, but there are moments that are just so pitch black. And the same thing with Extras. You know, the life of the extra is incredibly glamorous on the one hand in that you're standing right next to this multi-millionaire, and on the other hand, it's incredibly pathetic because, you know, you're making a couple, you know, making scale. So they've always kind of played with those ideas. So it's interesting to kind of tip the scales more into drama. And it's not a great film, but I do think it's an interesting one. Cemetery Junction, available on Netflix.
We have with us today a man who is so much a part of the culture that he scarcely needs an introduction. Pootie Tang, good to have you here with us.
Seventh Sound.
Pootie Tang, you've had incredible success, and you've had it in a variety of fields, music, films, martial arts, pottery. How do you do it? What makes you tick?
Well, Bob, I'm a Pone Tony. Got my dillies on a pepper tang.
I hear that. Now, Pootie, a lot of young artists really say that you are their inspiration.
Well, I can't say that they know, my brother. What a tie.
I understand, though, you got a new movie coming out. Is that right?
Yeah. It's called Sign Your Pity on the Runny Kind.
Wow. And who's in it besides yourself?
Oh, well, there's Trucky, Bad Biddy, Dirty D, Lacey, JB, Biggie Shorty, and Robert Vaughn.
Listener's Choice time, and for this episode, listeners said no. They did not want us to investigate the evolution of the female gross-out comedy in Bachelorette. No. They did not want us to consider the evolution of Spanish language horror in The Devil's Backbone. They wanted us to watch Pootie Tang. And then, I guess, dance on a street corner for 20 minutes like Wanda Sykes. Yes, it's Pootie Tang, which really captured the cultural zeitgeist on its initial release in November of 2001. you know, time of great uncertainty in America. We're looking for villains. We're looking for heroes, men of courage and trouser accessories. And here comes one to lead us through this dark future. And that man is Pootie Tang, played by Lance Crowther. And in the film, Pootie is basically a modern-day spoof of... Really, I thought of him as kind of the spoof of this blaxploitation hero, Dolomite, who's played by Rudy Ray Moore in two films, and really, in particular, The Human Tornado, which was the second film, the sequel, whose structure, it really kind of suggests Pootie Tang. You know, he's like the performer by day, or technically, I guess he's the performer by night, and then the karate-chopping crime fighter by day. And definitely, there are some strong parallels, at least structurally, between the two films. Pootie, hero to millions of young kids, is recruited by the evil Lecter Corporation to become their spokesman for their new fast food chain. And when he refuses, he's tricked and his magically powerful belt is stolen. And he's eventually replaced by an evil doppelganger who I won't spoil who plays the doppelganger because that's one of the good jokes in the film.
Definitely.
But he is nicknamed Duty Tang. Now, one of the writers on The Chris Rock Show, where Pootie Tang originated, was a young and still relatively unknown writer named Louis C.K. He'd worked for Late Night with Conan O'Brien. He'd worked on the short-lived Dana Carvey Show, and he also worked on The Chris Rock Show. Nowadays, we know Louis C.K. as this brilliant independent voice behind his own show on FX, Louis. So, Allison, this is what I want to know.
Okay.
One, do you see any of the Louis C.K. that would eventually emerge on television in Pootie Tang and... More importantly, did you wadita on the kami chow or did you kama kama on the lipa chai?
I will pass on the second two for now.
For now.
For now.
Fine.
In terms of the first question, it's an interesting one. I think that there have always been these two kind of impulses in CK's career, and he's clearly tended towards the personal as he's gone. Like right now, his show, I think one of the major qualities of it is this sense of this belief in honesty and kind of human connection through honesty, even as much as it will cause you pain sometimes. And, you know, it's so based on his life as a, you know, divorced father of two who works as a stand-up. It's just, it seems often to be these variations, these slightly surreal sometimes variations on things in his life, in his day-to-day life.
Yeah.
And it feels very much like stand-up in that way. Mm-hmm. But I think that Pootie Tang represents something that you see more maybe in his last show, Lucky Louie, on HBO, which played a lot with the sitcom, like the tropes of a sitcom, while kind of challenging them. It was a bit more of this abstract thing. I don't think Lucky Louie worked very well, but you could see the kind of formal experimentation behind it.
Yeah, and let's explain briefly, because for people who never saw, because I actually never saw it, but I know what it was. It was like a sitcom. It looked like an old-fashioned sitcom, multi-camera sitcom with a live studio audience.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. But then it would, you know, go in, it was on HBO.
Right.
It would go into this extremely dark, kind of profane material a lot
right,
of the time.
Okay. So it was playing with the form and format of the old-fashioned sitcom and trying to see how it would accommodate modern comedy.
Exactly. And to play off that contrast. And, you know, so you can understand the kind of interesting aspect to that idea, even if it doesn't necessarily...
Yeah, it is an interesting idea, whether or not it doesn't work.
Right, plays that well,
right.
You know. And I think that you see maybe some of that in Pootie Tang, where you're like, I get, you know, kind of some of the ideas that you're going for here.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily, in practice, all play out as maybe as well as it maybe looked on the page, I think. CK talked about how he was essentially fired by the time they got to the edit. They like the studio was so not happy with what they had signed on for that I don't think that this represents his vision as like he originally conceived it.
Right.
So I think you can see that a bit as well. Of
yeah.
Just
he has said that, yes.
Yeah. It doesn't feel like it's
a movie?
Well, I don't know that it doesn't feel like it's a movie so much as it feels like it's a movie that's been kind of reassembled from pieces.
Hacked to pieces and reassembled very awkwardly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, even from I think, for me, some of the more interesting things are the weird bits of, like, kind of flights of fancy. Like, the gorilla joke you mentioned before.
It's brilliant.
It's brilliant and so weird. And or the bit where he's Truckee, right? The narrator.
Yes.
By J.B. Smoove, who's also Pootie Tang's best friend.
Yes.
He narrates the film.
Yes.
And in one part, narrates, and then his character says the exact lines to him.
Right.
And
great bit.
Yeah, it's a great bit. It's completely strange. It also stylistically doesn't really fit in with anything else that has gone on in the film before.
No, because most of the narration is very straightforward and explanatory, and not as a joke. It's like literally like this is, it's like explaining every single character like we're morons. And sometimes like people will, he'll say the name of a character right before someone else on screen says it. And it's only in that scene where it's played as a laugh. You know, the rest of the movie, it's just really poorly done narration.
Right. Like, it's actually filling in, sometimes unnecessarily, or sometimes just because they don't seem to have the film there to, like, pull the story along.
Yeah. So, you hadn't seen the movie before.
I had not.
I had seen it once before. I saw it in the movie theater, and I hated it. And looking at it this week, start the movie, and I'm laughing hysterically. And I'm like, this movie is way funnier than I remembered. And then right around the 15-minute mark, maybe around the time that Wanda Sykes first starts dancing, and I counted how many times she dances in this movie, 623 times, and that is an accurate number. Right around that point, the whole movie for me just kind of deflated, and it really lost me. And when it became an attempt at a narrative, it fell right apart. And then I was going, oh, this movie is really pretty dire at times. And like you said, I think there are some really funny parts. I think the first 10, 15 minutes of it are brilliant. And then it's barely a movie after that. It's I don't know what to call it. It's a flim. It's not quite a film.
It's a flim.
It's a flim. You know, it's like almost there, you know. But as you said, like, he made something. He shot something. And then it was taken away from him and really kind of crudely assembled. I mean, it's really kind of amateurish at times. In terms of narrative, I mean, it's just a real discomfort with storytelling, which is so interesting because, as we said, he's such a brilliant storyteller in his stand-up and now on his show. But then again, on the flip side, I could throw this out at you just as a knock on him, even though I think he's brilliant and a genius. His show doesn't always have a standard format. Like, sometimes the stories are really short, you know, so maybe he's not all that comfortable with long form storytelling as a storyteller. Maybe he works best in small doses, in which case making a feature film was not the right venue for him. I don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea. And I think that the show Louis speaks really much, very much to how he's happy to have some bits be like 5 minutes,
right?
To have one story be 5 minutes and then have that be a part of an episode, and then there's a 15-minute other story,
right?
Not necessarily connected.
No, it's an anthology series.
Yeah,
almost.
And in fact, like, this sometimes contradictory. You know, it doesn't. It's not all in one consistent universe sometimes. And then, Pootie Tang doesn't necessarily seem like that consistent a universe either. You could say, but it does seem like it has a struggle between kind of like odd bits and pieces that are actually funnier than the main narrative. Like, the main narrative seems sometimes to be dragging the film down.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The story is the worst part of this movie. The funniest bits have nothing to do with the story. Yeah. It's like the flashback to, the gorilla joke is Chris Rock plays Pootie Tang's father in a very funny flashback where Pootie Tang is a little kid and Chris Rock is his stern father and teaching him about the ways of the world, and he has this belt that he uses to constantly smack him. And there's another really funny bit where, as a kid, Pootie Tang is thinking about stealing some apples, and out of nowhere, the belt smacks him, and then him and his buddy are looking around trying to find the dad, and they don't see him anywhere, but somehow he had slapped him. So anyway, he worked in, like, a factory. It's very Cemetery Junction. He worked in a factory, but he was killed on the job, you know, beat, when he was attacked by a gorilla, and then a really fake gorilla suit. The worst gorilla suit you've ever seen. This is worse than anything you've ever seen. Just comes out and just mauls Chris Rock.
And then they observe there was a third time it had happened in the factory. Like, the factory, only the third time, though. Like, the factory was, you know, mildly plagued by gorilla accidents.
Right. Great. But, and then there's a really funny deathbed scene. All that stuff is great. But, you know, I mean, look, this is what happens when you make a narrative film about a character who is unintelligible.
And is a sketch comedy character.
A sketch comedy character.
Has always strained, many films have strained to come up with a whole feature length worth of material for a
it's
sketch
not
comedy
easy.
Character.
Well, but especially when your character's whole joke is that no one understands what he's saying, but everyone around him kind of does. What are we going to do for 75 minutes when we don't understand the character? I mean, it is kind of funny when he starts talking to Bob Costas and Bob Costas understands him in the beginning of the movie.
Right.
But then at a certain point, I mean, they really make it kind of, they open itself up for this interpretation that Bob Costas appears again at the end of the movie. And actually, it's kind of a funny joke, because the idea is the whole movie is essentially a clip that he's played for Bob Costas on his talk show,
right?
Which is kind of funny. But when Bob Costas, we come back and he's still doing the same shtick, and Bob Costas kind of understands him, or at that point, it's the bloom is off the rose, you know,
right.
It's lost its luster. I don't know if you realize this, that whole structure is lifted from one of the actual sketches on the Chris Rock show.
I did not realize
Chris
that.
Chris Rock, where the Bob Costas character is played by Chris Rock. Chris Rock welcomes Pootie Tang as a guest on his show. They do an interview. They show a clip for the movie, Sign Your Pity on the Runny Time, which is the movie that we're watching, ostensibly. And then at the end, there's the same joke where he says something in gibberish, and finally Chris Rock goes, what are you talking about? You know, like, and then he says, Capital on the damn chai, and he's like, oh, okay. You know, like, it's the same exact structure. So even that, which kind of works, was taken from the original material and wasn't invented for the film.
So I wanted to ask you, Matt, I felt like Lance Crowther, who I think is mostly a writer, mm-hmm. and he's not performing, has not been like the main thrust of his mm-hmm. career, beyond the fact that his character is unintelligible, I felt like also, I mean, beyond the main joke of his character being this almost blaxploitation satire,
right.
He's not the most charismatic in the cast by far. And I think that there is a sense that he becomes this kind of blank in the center of the film.
Yeah.
Because he is this larger-than-life character, but also...
He doesn't feel larger-than-life,
really. Feel larger-than-life. He feels pretty small. I mean, like, one of the kind of... It's a good joke in the film, but also maybe exemplifies a problem, is when Pootie Tang records a hit single, and he records it by turning down all the levels
right.
on the producer's thing, you know, and then sings a silent song,
right?
And it becomes a huge hit, and
right.
that kind of explains the character perfectly, right? In that
he has nothing to say.
He has nothing to say, and also that he is this kind of symbolic
this
thing
emptiness
that they never filled in. Yeah,
yeah, that's a good it's a good point. No, he. He doesn't quite stand up to being the lead of a movie. And you're right. I think you summed it up really well. The character is supposed to be this larger-than-life icon that is adored by millions. And he can barely carry his own 75-minute movie. And when he's surrounded by all these much more charismatic actors, he does kind of seem to recede into the background. You could argue, I guess, that maybe that's part of the point, because this the other point of making a quote-unquote a hit song where it's just silence is this idea that, you know, pop culture is very manufactured and is empty of substance and kind of bland, and all of the people who become superstars are that way. And so maybe you could argue that he's kind of that way on purpose. I think you're being very generous if you make the argument, though.
I do think that there's a kind of genial good-naturedness to the film as a whole that I did like. I mean, even in terms of Pootie Tang willing to go seduce with Pi, this kind of plain daughter of a rural sheriff, just to make her feel better, you know? I think that there's a kind of... like, why not to that? And to the fact that he almost ends up marrying her.
Yeah, but then there's also the scene where he has that sort of groupie who comes along
mm-hmm.
and he leaves out a bowl of
milk and
then
stays,
she drinks it like a cat. I mean, that actually
sure
was
to...
not... That's sort of the opposite of what you're describing.
Yeah.
That scene made me kind of uncomfortable, and I thought that was awful.
I agree. I mean, like, in that his character... is presented as supposed to be like this ladies' man, though.
Right.
But from the whole film, it seems like a lot of the time he's acted upon in that way. You know what I mean? He's pursued by all of these characters, including Wanda Sykes, including Jennifer Coolidge, whose character is such a weird twist on this, like
Stifler's mom, Cougar.
Yeah.
Thing.
Like I did like actually that every scene in which she seduces someone is basically this act of terrible violence. I think there's even a scene of her with Robert Vaughn where she has like his legs thrown around her waist. Which
yes,
is
there
like,
is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind
of
funny.
Like, the idea of that as a twist on the like femme fatale is so strange, but it's pretty funny.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's wrap this up with just this question, you know, because Pootie Tang, it was a huge flop when it came out. It's taken on this sort of cult status. It hasn't become like, you know, huge cult film, but it has a small but very vocal following. Does it deserve it?
I don't think it's fully successful as a film. I think it has a lot of great weird moments. We didn't even mention maybe one of my favorite ones, which is a standoff between Pootie Tang and Dirty D, in which they kind of move closer and closer and closer together
until
without ever moving their legs.
Other.
Yeah,
very funny.
Which is very funny.
Yes,
it has a lot of those moments that are so strange and delightful. I do not think it holds together as a film as a whole.
No.
But I think that weirdness counts a lot in terms of having a cult following.
Right.
And that is certainly powering it forward. And it also just has this cast of all of these comedians. Most of whom it's better not to mention just because it's nice to see when they show up in these roles.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a great pedigree. And I think that sometimes something that has a great pedigree that didn't work out entirely, that's what cult followings are made for.
No, it's true. I think it has a great first 15 minutes or so, and there are some really inspired bits. I don't think it holds up as a movie. I mean, this to me would not be a cult film that I would hold up as a classic. I think it's an interesting failure, I guess, is more of what I would say. And I think I haven't looked on YouTube, but I would guess that probably most of the best parts are on YouTube. And that's probably how I would recommend appreciating it. Watch the best scenes on YouTube. It's not like you're going to miss anything if you don't capture the whole narrative experience as a whole. I think the best bits work as little sketches, which is probably how they were originally envisioned anyway. So that's Pootie Tang, and it is available now on Netflix.
Now it's time for Behind the Eight Ball, in which we give you a rapid-fire countdown of three picks that are new to streaming, one, in this case, that's expiring soon, and one pick chosen blindly by number from our Netflix queues. We're only doing one expiring film this week since we're recording a little early. Matt's off to Fantastic Fest, and there aren't that many expiring titles up yet, so we went with just one each.
Right.
So are you ready, Matt?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, three new films.
Okay, first up, speaking of Fantastic Fest, is a film I saw at Fantastic Fest last year and really enjoyed. It's called Headhunters. It'll be available on Netflix starting on September 27th. It's a Norwegian film about an art thief and his relationship with his wife, who he feels inadequate towards, and so he constantly feels like he has to buy her things and steal her things because he can't afford their lifestyle. And it takes some interesting twists from there. Really nice little thriller. I think was under the radar, but worth a watch on Netflix. Next up, available on Fandor, is The Trial, Orson Welles' adaptation of the Kafka novel. I've actually never seen it, so I'm looking forward to watching it myself. That's on Fandor. And finally, a perfect segue from Kafka to Jackass the Movie, available starting on October 1st on Netflix. A Kafka-esque experience, really, in all ways, I think. Or not at all. But it's a really hilarious movie. I'm an unashamed fan, supporter, apologist of the Jackass oeuvre. I love all the movies, the show, everything. I hope they make 100 more. I hope there's Jackass 60. I will have seen every single one. The last one was fantastic. So that's Jackass the Movie on October 1st on Netflix.
Okay, one expiring film.
Yeah, and this one is expiring because there is such a small supply. This one's expiring very quickly. If you're listening to this show within the first few days only, you'll be able to catch it. Otherwise, unfortunately, you'll miss it. But we'll have more expiring stuff on our next episode. This is No Direction Home, a fantastic documentary by Martin Scorsese about Bob Dylan. Really an essential documentary about his life and work. It's expiring on September 26th. You don't have a lot of time, but if you're hearing this and it's still available, check it out.
All right, and one from your queue.
You gave me number 9, which this week is not as embarrassing, thankfully. It's the film The Catechism Cataclysm. It's from Todd Rohal. It's described on Netflix as, after his relationship to the church sours, a young priest and his high school pal take a canoe trip where they recall their glory days in rock bands, but they realize they're lost as darkness falls and the night begins to bring bizarre turns of events. And it stars Steve Little from Eastbound and Down, a show that I really like, and a performer on that show that I really like. So I'm looking forward to checking that out. Okay, are you ready for your countdown, Allison?
I am ready.
Okay, let's start with three new releases.
Okay, the first one is a film that I haven't seen yet, and I'm really glad that it's streaming because I'm really looking forward to seeing it. It is The Tin Drum, the 1979 film, streaming on Hulu. It's a film adaptation of the novel of the same name by Günter Grass, winner of the Palme d'Or, winner of the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar, about a boy named Oscar who decides to stop growing at the age of 3 and manages it through either an injury or force of will. And it kind of takes them through the war and a lot of interesting themes. So that is The Tin Drum. It is on Hulu. Next is Shooting Robert King, 2008 documentary that's streaming on Netflix. And I like this documentary a lot, actually. It's directed by Richard Perry, and it's about an American photojournalist, the name and the title, and it follows his career for like 15 years as he starts off this like complete novice and kind of an idiot who just ventures into Bosnia and does all of these unsafe things and becomes an award-winning photojournalist and also develops a lot of problems because of it. I covered Sarajevo and Grozny, and it really delves into ideas of what the obligation of a war journalist is, and, you know, and also just what the price is of witnessing these images. So that's Shooting Robert King on Netflix. And last but not least, Revenge Season 1 is available on Netflix. This is a modern-day reimagining of The Count of Monte Cristo set in the Hamptons, starring Emily Van Camp, Madeleine Stowe, Gabriel Mann. I would say this is a guilty pleasure, but I don't feel...
The name is Van Camp?
Emily Van Camp.
That's amazing.
And I, you know, I would say this is a guilty pleasure, but I don't feel guilty. Oh. Why feel guilty?
All right.
It is a really kind of very fun, enjoyable, somewhat ridiculous drama filled with twists
trash.
And betrayal.
It's trash.
It is not trash.
All right. Do you have your one expiring title?
I do. This is another one I haven't seen, but I've actually really been meaning to, so I'm glad that it's on Netflix because it stars my favorite Tom Hardy. It is the masterpiece classic 2009 Wuthering Heights, which was filmed for British television, starring Tom Hardy as Heathcliff and Charlotte Riley, who I believe is now his fiance, as Kathy, based on the Emily Bronte book. And this is a peek at Hardy kind of before, as he was just sort of starting to break big, you know, Inception, I think, was had not yet come out when he shot this, so you know, then now he's of course a big star, so it's always interesting to see someone on the cusp of breaking out. And that is Wuthering Heights. It is expiring October 1st from Netflix.
Okay, and one random film from your queue?
You picked number 32, which is The Manx Man, 1929, Alfred Hitchcock's last silent film. I think I just went and had added at one point all of Hitchcock that was on that I hadn't seen to my queue. So this is a film about a poor fisherman who heads out to the seas in hopes of earning enough money to impress the father of his girlfriend. Then he is possibly lost at sea. So, you know, always, I haven't seen a lot of that early Hitchcock.
I'm sure you'll be watching that one real
I'm
soon.
I'm sure I will too. Yeah. I keep getting rushed right over as soon as I'm finished with rewatching Revenge Season 1.
Okay, well, it's time to go through our listeners' choice options for our next episode. Let's start with the first one, Allison. What is it?
It is The Tall Man, which is available on VOD on September 25th, and also, as far as we can tell, on streaming on Netflix.
We could be mistaken, but we believe it's actually going to be available on Netflix on the same day.
Yeah, which is a pretty quick turnaround because this film was in theaters not very long ago.
Like a month ago.
Yeah, so this is the new film from Pascal Laugier, who directed Martyrs, which, if you've seen it, you know if you've seen it. It is maybe, I think for me, the kind of the be-all, end-all of torture porn films. This is also a genre film of sorts, though neither of us has seen it yet. It's not in the same vein. Stars Jessica Biel, and it's about a mother whose child goes missing and then goes investigating the legend of the Tall Man, who is supposedly this...
Manute Bol.
Yes, or person who abducts children.
Oh.
Yes. So that is The Tall Man. It's available on VOD and possibly
I was
streaming.
Confused. I don't think Manute Bol is a kidnapper. Let's just put that out there.
Okay, why don't you tell us about the next film?
Okay, the next film, which doesn't star Manute Bol either, is Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, which will be available on Netflix starting on October 1st from 1982. Directed by Nicholas Meyer, and this movie has been getting a lot of... I've been seeing some articles about it, some discussions on other podcasts about it, because it's the 30th anniversary, and if that doesn't make you cry, then you're not as old as I am, but it's the 30th anniversary of Star Trek II. It's the 30th anniversary of the summer of 82, which had a whole retrospective at the Alamo Drafthouse this summer. It was an amazing summer for movies that summer. They had Conan... They had Road Warrior, Rocky III, Poltergeist, E.T., The Thing, Tron, Class of 1984, The Dark Crystal... and Star Trek II. They all came out the same summer. That's kind of insane. It was a drastic departure from the first Star Trek movie in that it was actually pretty good. It was a direct sequel to an episode from the original series. Allison, that episode was called, of course...
I can't believe you're looking at me and asking me that question.
I know. It's called Space Seed, and it had Ricardo Montalban as Khan, and he returned for the film. And as you may be able to tell from that joke, Allison has never seen Star Trek.
I have not seen it.
Have you seen any Star Trek movies?
No.
Did you see the J.J. Abrams one?
Yes.
Okay.
I've seen like some of the newer ones, but I have not seen...
You saw some of the Next Generation ones?
Yes.
Okay. So you have never seen any of the original series movies?
That is correct.
All right. Well, I just thought... I just this is me being selfish. I just want to make Allison watch Star Trek II, and I'd love to hear what she thinks of it. And I do think it would be interesting, too, because there has been so much discussion about that summer, the summer of 1982. Maybe we could even have that as our theme. We could do movies from that year as our theme on that show. That could be kind of fun. So a look back and considering how that movie is aging could be pretty fun. Star Trek II, available on Netflix on October 1st.
Okay, and our last film is also going to be available on Netflix. It is From Russia with Love, which will be available on streaming October 1st, directed by Terrence Young. It's the second Bond film, and it's one in which Bond is trying to track down a Russian decoding device before Spectre finds it first.
He needs to get the Lecter.
Exactly. Sean Connery as Bond.
They could tell from my impression.
I just wanted
exactly
to be clear in
I
case
think they
that
all knew.
I'm, yeah, okay.
It's that good.
Uh-huh. It's, you know, Russian girl that Bond is linked with. And there's also, there's poison-tipped shoes and the usual classic Bond hijinks. And, we picked this in particular because we were interested in, there was an essay published recently, from Matt Zoller Seitz on the Press Play blog, in which he wrote about attending a screening in which a lot of people kind of tittered at the film.
Young people watching it were kind of not, they were just laughing at the movie as if it was really dated and cheesy. Sort of what we were saying about like looking at Star Trek and seeing how it's aging.
Exactly.
Apparently they felt that this movie was completely dated and silly, and they were just sort of, I believe the expression would be taking the piss out of it, essentially.
Right. And so he wrote a response to basically be like, it's your problem if
right.
you can't put yourself in the right mindset
right.
to accept this film. So I thought that would be an interesting thing to talk about. Also
right.
interesting to revisit this. And of course, the new Bond film, Skyfall, which is directed by Sam Mendes, is coming out November 9th.
Right.
And it is really interesting to look at how Bond has changed over the years.
Yeah. So there's definitely some themes there we could do. We could do Bond. We could do spy movies. We could do all sorts of things there. So there's a lot of potential there as well.
Yes. So that's From Russia with Love on Netflix.
All right, well, which movie should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? Send your pick to feedback at filmspottingsvu.com or enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, October 1st at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu, and you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on our next episode, which will be on or around Monday, October 9th.
FilmspottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Filmspotting SVU remixed theme song is by Vince Vandal. Listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie review that you pick. In the meantime, you can follow me and Matt on Twitter, twitter.com/MattSinger and twitter.com/AllisonWilmore. And you can follow the show at twitter.com/FilmspottingSVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from SVU listeners. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Sadate.